This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Across Northern Ireland, on your radio and on BBC Sounds. This is
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Three big questions on the programme today. Number one, is it time to bring in the military to help our medical staff cope with the enormous pressure on our hospital emergency departments at the moment? That's number one. Number two, do you believe the late Queen Elizabeth II actually called the marching season that silly marching business once? Do you think she would have said that? Question number three, are Manchester United back? We know they battered Liverpool on Sunday. Oh yeah, they only got a 2-2 draw, but we know which was the better team. Are Manchester United back? That and a lot more on the podcast today.
The Stephen Nolan Show!
It's cold out there and it's going to be cold all week, so please be careful, particularly because none of us want to end up in an emergency department at the moment. In fact, a local nurse has told the Nolan Show the pressures within the health service at the moment are the worst she's seen in a decade. Pauline, not her real name, says staff morale is in a very bad place.
In the last 10 years, I don't think I've seen it this bad. I became a nurse because I wanted to care for people. And I feel like we're just kind of clutching at straws at the minute, and we're putting plasters over hemorrhaging wounds is the way to describe it. So I want us to do better. I want us to be better.
We'll hear the rest of that interview in a moment. But first, let's speak to our health correspondent, Marie-Louise Connolly. Good morning, Marie-Louise.
Good morning, Mark.
And I know you spent yesterday bashing the phones, talking to your contacts at all levels of the health service. Remind us what you were hearing.
Yeah, it was really a grim picture. And that's how one nurse who has been working in an ED in Northern Ireland for most of last week and on Saturday described the conditions that she has been working in. She said it was just grim, that she didn't, she was fearful about going to work on her shifts, and that every day that she was coming into a packed area, a packed ED area, and she said she put the head down and she got on with it. One phrase that someone has said to me over the weekend has really stuck with me, that corridor care has become the norm. And you know what that is like. We've seen those pictures where on a corridor, an ED corridor, areas that are meant to be free in order to move trolleys up and down, particularly outside where ambulances drop off, those are now being used to nurse and care for patients. That's not good for the patient, but it's also not good for staff and for staff morale, who are trying to deliver the best care they can for very sick people. Also, what emerged over the weekend, and Mark, again, this is not new. We have been reporting this for a decade. The most chronic of patients are turning up now at emergency departments because they cannot access perhaps care in general practice. And then they turn up here. That could be patients with, severe breathing problems, COPD patients, even cancer patients. And those patients are all turning up at ED, including those who maybe started off with a bad cold, a chest infection, and then over Christmas, the new year, that has developed into pneumonia. And they're all here at the ED, and there's no room for them elsewhere in the hospital to find a bed to be cared for. It really is a dire situation.
And the next couple of weeks are where it could get even worse. Are you hearing anything, Marie-Louise, about possible short-term, quick, radical plans to try and alleviate the situation?
Yeah, well, staff has said, it's a little bit too late. Whenever the Department of Health, along with the various health trusts, were putting together their winter pressure plan, and Mike Nesbitt, the Health Minister, and others have said that they have been working on this for many, many weeks, prior to November. People are saying, who are working here, there's no evidence really that those plans have kicked in. Now, some of the solutions, and this might shock people, but what some people were saying to me, people have been saying, why not bring back the military? You know, they were brought in during the pandemic when that was a declared emergency. If you're working in this scenario, you feel you are in an emergency. So bring back the military, they said, even for 3 weeks of that peak in December, January, they know it's coming. They know it's going to happen. It's predictable. So why not have staff at the ready to be brought in for those 3 weeks? Also, someone said to me that the Nightingale Hospital, which was used during the pandemic, and also White Abbey Hospital, there is bed availability there. So why not? Why wasn't that part of the contingency plan? That for those patients who are medically fit to be discharged, but who can't go home because they still need a little bit of care, a little bit of support, why not put them into places like Nightingale and White Abbey Hospital? I then put it to those senior clinicians, but sure, we don't have the staff, we're told, to man those beds. And they said, well, it's in these emergency times that you either use the nursing agencies or you would have used the military in order to care for those patients. So they feel that there are little loopholes that could be used. Also, nursing homes. A lot of the patients that are in hospitals are older patients, Mark. They perhaps have been brought in from a nursing home. Someone who works in a nursing home said to me on Thursday night, if there was more flexibility for nursing home patients not to have to send residents straight to ED, that they can call upon a GP or a doctor. It's all of those little things all add up, which could prevent perhaps every day a half a dozen older people not having to come to the ED.
And just finally, I know you've got a busy day ahead. You'll be bringing us further news on what's happening at the moment on BBC Newsline tonight at 6:30, is that right?
Yes, Mark. You know, we're hoping to bring you more from what's happening within the emergency department across Northern Ireland. And it's also what the public can do to help themselves and to help those working in the health service. We have heard Public Health Agency this morning and the Health Minister still saying to staff, if you can get a flu jab, get one, whether you have an underlying health condition or not. Now, we are reporting that many people are saying that they cannot access one to buy in a pharmacy. Mm-hmm. That is an issue. I have heard many people saying that when they go to a pharmacy, they're saying that stock of jabs for those people who want to buy it over the counter, that they're not widely available. That's something BBC News is going to try and tackle during the day. But also, as you talked about at the top of the programme, this cold snap. Think about, do you really need to go out? Because what the emergency departments don't need at this moment in time are car accidents or people falling. That all adds pressure on an already pressurised system. So the people in here, the nurses, the doctors, are saying, you know, please think twice. Please think about helping us within the hospital, about going out, about mixing with people, about hand hygiene, about just looking after yourself, washing your hands, doing all those little things which could prevent people from catching the flu and therefore not developing an illness, which means that they end up in an emergency department. And Mark, we should say that in an emergency, of course, you ring 999,
yes,
despite what you're hearing on the airwaves,
yes,
despite what you're reading in your newspaper. If you are suffering a heart attack or stroke or an emergency, those services are still there for you.
Thank you, Mary Louise. It seems every time we come to this part of the year, you're busier than ever. We appreciate your time as well. You're kind of holding our hand through all this. That's good advice from our health correspondent, Mary Louise Connolly. Yeah, we've got to be careful if we cycle, if we drive, even if we're walking on pavements, if we're playing sport. Let's be cautious, but if there's a real emergency, my goodness, please, please, please get medical assistance. But what about a short, sharp measure like bringing in the army? We remember it happened during the COVID pandemic. Are we in that situation now? Are we at that crisis point whereby we should be asking the military to help our existing civilian medical staff. Well, I put that idea to Dr. Michael Perry, who's Vice Chair of the Royal College of Medical and Emergency Medicine in Northern Ireland. I put it to him, do you think it's time we brought in the army?
The answer is I don't know the honest answer to that. What the biggest thing we can try and do to help with the situation is the patients that are fit to be have had their medical treatment completed, but are able but unfortunately need social care. Is how can we get them discharged from our acute hospitals to get the emergency patients in? I don't know how. I know that's a very, very difficult question and solution.
Why wouldn't you do it if potentially they're available? We know there's what seems to be a crisis at the moment. Why wouldn't you get them in?
I mean, it's bringing them in. So the issue is not necessarily bringing people into the hospital. It's getting patients out of hospital, getting the flow through the hospital better. Now, if we can find facilities or step down facilities which can be staffed to allow patients to come out of hospital to await their social care, then there might be a benefit of say with the military to come in to do that. But From our perspective, the biggest issue is its flow throughout the hospital and getting patients discharged out through the back door who are ready to who've had their medical care completed to allow the next acutely ill patient to come in and into those beds. That's the biggest thing that's going to improve the situation in our EDs.
Capacity is a big issue as well. We're told that maybe there is spare capacity if White Abbey, the Nightingale, were opened. What do you think of those ideas?
It depends on the context. I mean, if they're opened for to allow, as I say, patients who may be awaiting social care, who've had their acute illness completed, who could be moved into those facilities, then yes, absolutely. Again, it's a staffing issue. We have to make sure that those facilities will be staffed appropriately. And again, that's a decision for the department and I'm aware of the fiscal situation, the money situation. That'll be a decision for them to take. We're certainly happy to help provide, or as the college, to try and find solutions to work with the department to try and solve this. But I'm under no illusion how difficult and how challenging that the answer is going to be.
I mean, to be brutal about it, are people potentially going to die because of the system that otherwise might have lived?
The short answer is yes, because we have said before, our college has published data before about the mortality, excess mortality aspect of overcrowding in EDs, and it's been it's been presented to the Commons Select Committee in England by our president, and it's we have evidence that overcrowding in EDs causes harm and it causes mortality. So this is why emergency medicine and our college have been shouting from the rooftops about this issue for so long, is because we know the harm that this does. We see it on a daily basis. It's not a case of, we're busy, we need a breather. It's a case of it's the harm to the patients that it causes, and this is why this needs to be addressed. And it needs to be. This is why I'm very keen to sort of get out there that this isn't get over flu and things will be okay. This is a system which has been in linear decline for 10, 15 years. We need to reverse that trend now, and it's going to take, it's going to take a lot of work and a lot of planning. It's going to take time as well, but we need to reverse that trend for that reason.
And if it's not the military, if it's not opening White Abbey and the Nightingale, what could help today and tomorrow and the next day?
What I would say is that if we have patients in hospital who are awaiting hermetically cleared to be discharged from hospital, but requiring social care. I mean, if any families can help to help facilitate, to allow any patient to be discharged from hospital, that'd be helpful to us. Another thing I would say is to be patient with our staff in emergency departments, because we know how unacceptable the situation is at the minute. We know how. I haven't been on the side of the fence with as a patient in ED myself, but I can't think of anything worse than having to wait in the back of an ambulance for a large number of hours, to wait for 10 plus hours to be assessed by a doctor, and then waiting 2 to 3 days, sometimes in a car or for a bed or in a chair. I just can't comprehend how anybody could go through that. We know this is unacceptable, so please be patient with our staff. If you are a patient or a relative.
Have you been speaking to members of staff? How are they doing?
Our staff are, I don't like the term resilient, but they are a very resilient bunch. We have been working in this environment for a very, very long time. The morale is low. Our staff are not surprised by the situation we're in. A lot of them predicted it. A lot of them knew we would be in this situation. A lot of them are deflated and almost disillusioned with the fact that we don't have a light. We need to see some light at the end of the tunnel of this here. A lot of us just can't see at the minute the way things are going. When are we going to get out of this? When are things going to improve? As I said, personally, and whenever I've gone in the car to drive to work in the morning, I have asked myself, why am I doing this? I've been doing this for a long time now, but why am I still doing this? And I'm sure a lot of our staff ask the same questions, but they still turn up and they still come in and they do their job, and they do a really good job, and they need absolutely, I can't praise them enough for that. But
sorry, even you are thinking about whether or not it's time to do something else?
I'm in this for the long haul. But the thought does. There are days when you get up and you are, you know, as we all do. We get up and we don't feel it, and we get in the car and we go, why am I going in here? But you still do, and you still do, and you still go and do the best job you can. What I'm sort of saying is that, you know, there are people, there are good people who still come in every day and do this job to the best that they can. But my worry is that they all have, you know, everybody has a tolerance and a breaking point. And what we can't afford is, retention and recruitment is so important. We need to retain our emergency department staff. We don't want them to go elsewhere. We need them to stay in emergency medicine and work in our departments. We can't afford to lose that skill from our hospital.
Finally, in a sentence or two, the Health Minister, Mike Nesbitt, we're told he was, without the media, touring hospital wards over Christmas, including right at the heart of Christmas. Do you think he gets it?
I personally, yes, I do. The minister, as he stated in last week in the media, he reached out to our college and to speak with him last week about, you know, the issues that are going. And, you know, I heard him talking on the media last week about flow and, you know, the number, talking the language that our college has been talking for a long, long time. So it's great. It's good for me. It's good that we have somebody who's saying those things. But it's the solutions and finding the solutions. That's the really difficult part. And I don't envy the minister's job, because the answers to this are going to be very, very difficult, but we must tackle them. And, you know, ourselves at our college and emergency medicine clinicians are absolutely willing to help try and find the solutions, to be a part of this, to try and find the answer.
Easier said than done. That's Dr. Michael Perry. We appreciate him coming on. We appreciate his honesty. Everybody's been very candid about just how bad the situation is. And it seems people are open to short-term fixes, but they can't decide what they're going to be. Frank in Belfast, Happy New Year to you, Frank. First caller of 2025, or 2023, as I'm going to call it. All good with you, Frank?
Yes, yes. Well, I worry terribly about this before because I've survived in it. But one thing that drew my attention was where to put the patients and who is available to care for them. And it reminded me of the Troubles.
Are you going to say bring in the army, Frank?
Yes, 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 because I was in the army.
Okay.
And I was stationed at Musgrave Park. And at the hospital, the military had a hospital there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right, as soon as you go in, the wee guy that you see first, you know, across the road from him, there was a military hospital. And there was lots of wards. And
okay.
there was prisoners that needed hospital travel.
And soldiers as well, Frank. But
soldiers,
to bring it back up to date, you think it's time to bring them back?
I was a soldier.
You think it's time to bring them back, Frank?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
And open even that hospital, which is really not been used ever since then.
Okay.
And they could get them in there, all people.
Frank, thank you. I'm told there is capacity at White Abbey. And also this Nightingale unit at Belfast City Hospital. But, you know, having a building is one thing. You need staff as well. Let's bring in the Alliance Party's health spokesperson, Danny Donnelly. Good morning, Danny.
Good morning, Mark.
What do you think about bringing in the army?
I think certainly we should consider all options. You'd mentioned about being able to staff units there at the minute. The staff that we have at the minute are going above and beyond, as they always do, but they're exhausted. Their morale is very, very low at the minute. And certainly we've seen cases of staff getting sick now as well. Staff aren't immune from getting sick themselves. So, you know, we're under huge, huge pressure from staffing, and it would be about staffing any available units to create that capacity. I was very struck there by what Dr. Perry was saying about people dying who wouldn't have died otherwise. Now, that is completely unacceptable. That's a terrifying situation to be in, that harm is being caused to patients because of the way the health system is working at the minute. So it really is a shocking situation. Now, as a nurse myself, I've seen this get worse and worse and worse over the years. We know that winter pressures happen. They're predictable. They're expected every year. You know, we need to be more ahead of this every year. I know the minister has talked about starting with a blank page next year, but we need action now.
Mm.
So I think everybody agrees that we need action, but nobody has agreed what the action is.
Danny, we're going to come back to you after the 9:30 news, but before we do that, let's talk to a retired GP. Robert is on the line. Good morning, Robert. As we know, some GPs are getting it in the neck, if you pardon the pun here, saying that, you know, our hospital emergency departments wouldn't be so busy if you could see face-to-face your GP.
Right. Well, Mark, you've been talking there that you've got 400 patients waiting for a hospital bed at the minute. Now, you can't really blame a GP for that there. Those patients have been assessed by a doctor, maybe have been referred to the hospital by their GP, and they're waiting for beds. So they're that ill that they're too ill to be treated at home. So those 400 patients, you can't expect GPs to be looking after them in the community when they're so ill.
But you know, there is this complaint that since COVID, it's been harder to get a face-to-face consultation. And some people think actually it's easier to go up to the A&E unit.
Yes, that could be a problem, Mark, indeed. But I'm just talking about those 400 patients that are so ill that require admission. There's another 400 patients you say that are maybe waiting that maybe possibly might have been able to be treated by their GP if they could see them.
So what's the solution, Robert?
I don't really know. Honestly, you know, I'm retired 10 years now. So when I was working, we used to have open surgeries where you just turned up at the surgery and you were seen straight away or seen within 2 or 3 hours. But I think now it's a slightly different system. So I'm not that sure. But I think GPs get an awful lot of blame Like, if you've got these very ill people in the community being treated, the GP is going to be out continually seeing them and reassessing them.
Yeah.
And it's basically like a GP is running a ward in the community.
Yes, that's where it's at. Robert, thank you. That's the latest from Robert, retired GP in Donaghadee. You're phoning us in your droves. Keep the calls coming. We'll have a lot more on the programme between now and 10 o'clock. We'll keep it going until until half past 10. Don't worry, Connor Phillips, we're not going to eat into your time. The time is coming up to 9:31. We've just got some numbers for you, which are quite sobering, to say the least. This is in terms of hospital emergency departments, the average waiting time as of 8 o'clock this morning. Listen to this. The Mater Hospital, over 4 hours. The Royal Victoria Hospital, over 5 hours. Royal Children's Hospital, 1 hour. Antrim Area Hospital, more than 12 hours. That's the average waiting time in the emergency department. I'll go through the others very quickly. Causeway, more than 5 hours. Craigavon, more than 2 hours. Just under an hour at Daisy Hill and Newry. Ulster Hospital, more than 5 hours waiting time. Altnagelvin, just under 2 hours waiting time. And at the Southwest Acute Hospital, the average waiting time is 48 minutes. Danny Donnelly is still with us from the Alliance Party. What do you make of that, Danny?
Shocking to hear. But as I said earlier, these pressures are predictable and they are expected. We know there's a big uptick in demand at this time of year every year. So we need a plan in place so that we can meet the demand that patients are coming in. A big part of the problem is the patient flow. I think that has been highlighted, that we need to get patients into those acute medical beds. And that means moving people on from when they're stabilised and when their treatment is finished. So we need to keep that flow happening. Now, whether that's moving people into the community or into other areas in order to get people up from any into those acute medical beds.
Thanks to everybody who's phoned in. Keep the calls coming. Clearly, a lot of you have been in hospital, sadly, whether it's you yourself or visiting a friend or a relative over the Christmas period. Were you there when the Health Minister, Mike Nesbitt, visited one of the wards? Did you get a chance to chat to him? We'd love to chat to him on the programme today. Hopefully we'll get him before the end of this week. But did you see Mike Nesbitt? Tell us what you told him. Tell us what you want to tell all of us this morning, this Monday morning, about the pressures on our health service. Let's hear what some of you who have phoned in already are saying. Gilly in Belfast, good morning.
Good morning, how are you?
How are you?
I'm good. But basically, I was ringing in to inform you. I was at, I don't know if I could say it, the hospital on Thursday night with my sister. And there was one disruptive patient in the accident emergency. And for that one patient, there was a waste of resources by 4 police cars being there for that one person all night.
My goodness.
Yeah.
What did you see in terms of queuing, people waiting for treatment?
Well, there's a bit of a backstory. My sister had been at another hospital and had waited for 33 hours.
What?
33 hours. She was in another hospital and was sent out and on her way. And then she came to stay with me and she was as bad as ever again, which meant then I took her to a hospital down near me. We were within about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. We weren't home to 7 o'clock the next morning, but the care she received was exceptional.
Well, that's good to hear. Yeah, we're not blaming the staff, Gilly. Listen, thank you. I hope you get a better chance or a better time with your family there. It sounds as if you've had a lot of illness. What about Gareth in Kirkcubbin? Morning, Gareth. What's your situation?
Morning, Mark. Happy New Year. Yes, I am just talking about, personal experience with visiting people, etc. But at the end of the day, we have a mixture of a digital system and an analogue system. And it's funny how you quoted the figures for the Ulster, and the Ulster's at the highest waiting times.
No, I don't think it. I think Antrim is. Let me just go back there just to make this clear.
Ulster's
Antrim's more
up
than 12 hours. I think you're right. Ulster, no, it's not. Craigavon has 2 hours, 30 minutes. Where is the Ulster? Yes, there it is. The Ulster has, oh, I can't find it. 5 hours and 11 minutes.
5 hours. And it's a hospital that has loads of new wards. And that's what I'm talking about, digital and analog. I'm not blaming the architects. They designed those wards 15 years ago, whenever they thought the flow was going to be better. But you were talking about short, sharp, boosts to try and get the system to work. But this is not a short-term problem. This is a medium-term problem because those wards cannot just be increased overnight. And we already know the profile of our population and that those baby boomers, unfortunately, will need healthcare in the next few years. So this isn't a short, sharp problem. This is a medium-term problem because we have these wards with big atriums, big halls, big individual rooms. They're automatically with less capacity. And it is the capacity that we need in the medium term because we cannot just switch that off overnight. You know yourself, Mark, during the summer, we were being told that it was just as busy in the summer as what it is in the winter.
Yeah, yeah.
And therefore, that means that not a single bed needs to be removed. White Abbey and other places like White Abbey have to stay open because this isn't just a short, sharp problem. This is a medium-term problem, Mark.
It's both, though, Gareth, as well. You need to do something for today and tomorrow and the next day, as well as Mike Nesbitt getting everybody around the table to sort out next
just
winter as well.
Thing. You're saying, let's not be too hard on the staff, and I agree with you 100%. They are trying their best. And I'm also not trying to be ungrateful, by the way. It's wonderful that there's good individual rooms. It's wonderful that there aren't mixed wards.
Yeah.
Et cetera, et cetera. But I think it's gone too far the other way. And like I said, digital and analog, what has been built is not compatible with what we have now. And it is going to be a medium-term problem now, or a medium-term challenge to sort all of that out, Mark.
Gareth, thank you. You're on fire this morning. That certainly warmed us all up. What about Jim in South Belfast? Morning, Jim.
Hey, good morning, Mark. My feeling is we need to go back and look at what happened during COVID. The responsibility was taken off the doctors, off the consultants, off the hospitals, and they were told, this is what you're going to do. Okay? That's what needs to happen. Central government needs to have a plan. They do have the plan, by the way. They do have the plan set there and ready to go. And they can open any hospital, as they did with the so-called Nightingale hospitals. Right? They can do it today at the stroke of a pen. Why are they not doing it? What's the reason behind it?
They have to be staffed and they need the money.
They have the army. They have the private businesses. Can you imagine? I want you to picture this. Can you imagine one of the private hospitals, a doctor coming on and you're giving them things over the phone? Well, what about this? What about that? Well, oh, I don't think that. Oh, I don't think that's a good idea. I don't think that's the problem. That's the problem. They've done this for years and years and years, and the same results. You need to change. You cannot continually stand every year and do the same thing and expect different results.
Jim,
it
thank you.
It hasn't changed in many years. All the best.
Jim, happy new year to you. Grace in Banbridge, how's your year been so far?
Well, my year has been all right.
Grace, have you got the radio on in the background there?
Yes, we'll get it off.
Go on. I tell you what, we'll wait for you. We'll go to Craig Avon. We'll go up the road or down the road to Craig Avon from Banbridge. My geography's terrible. Sam, where are you?
How you going? I was just ringing in there to say to you, I think you should start charging people. Casually, 40 or 50 quid a go. Now, there is genuine people who's in there, they're not well. But my mother was taken into Craig Avon 2 weeks before Christmas. Every night, every weekend, the place was like Beirut. It was unreal. But Christmas Day, I was in seeing my mother Christmas Day, and there was nobody in casually at all. So I found it very strange how all these people can be all sick, and then Christmas Day, nobody's sick. And I think the problem is half of these people are going and using casualty, and there's nothing wrong with them.
Sam, how do you know that? How do you know that?
Well, explain to me why on Christmas Day it was empty.
And tell me this, would you means test it? It's not fair on low-income families or people who are in poverty.
But I tell you, if you're not well and you're ill and you're on the brew, your family or somebody will get you up 40 or 50 quid to get you seen. That's just putting the strain on this here. There's too many people using casualty, and there's nothing wrong with them. I've seen it Christmas Day. There was maybe two or three people in it. Up until then, it was like a bomb scare.
Sam, why would you bother? Why would you bother going to casualty if there's nothing wrong with you?
Yeah, well, that's what I can't understand, because, as I say, Christmas Day, it was empty. And maybe two or three people in it. Up until then, it was bunged.
And back to your proposal, how much would you charge people at the door?
40, 50 quid.
And you wouldn't means test that?
No. And I would take the pressure off the whole thing. Another thing too, the lady on earlier on said she took her sister to casualty, and but the police and all been there, and a waste of resources. I seen it too. Like, I seen the police bringing some guy in handcuffs, and like, he was getting seen before anybody else. Yeah. It does need a real, real shake-up. And another thing I like to add, I don't think politicians should be running it. I think it's businessmen should be running the
NHS. Or women.
Sorry. Yeah. But I think it's business people should be running it. But as I said, that's my point.
Okay.
Christmas Day, it was empty.
Interesting. Sam, was it your mum you were going to see, did you say?
Yeah, and she's still in, and she's getting great care of them people, but they're under pressure too.
Yes, yeah. Well, if she's listening, I hope she gets well soon. Grace, have you turned your wireless off yet?
I have, yes.
Give us your point now.
No, in the Southern Health and Social Care Trust, there's such a thing as the acute care at home service for older people. Now, older people, remark you. And my late husband had it, and I can recommend it. It is absolutely, it's 100%. Now, he had a drip up, he had his antibiotic in the drip, and he had a doctor coming in, a physiotherapist, the whole works, and it keeps older people out of hospitals.
So it's a home care package he had?
It is, yes. Actually, for my niece's son, who's a doctor, is actually working in it at the present time. And they go out to your home. The drip was put up over a coat hanger over the curtain pole in the living room. Mm. But the care is absolutely 100%.
But Grace, so
I was a nurse myself. And
where are you?
I can recommend.
Where were you a nurse?
I trained in England, but I was in the Royal. I was in Mid-Ulster and Macherfield. I was in the Royal, and I was in Banbridge.
Oh, you got a bout.
No longer exists.
Well, Grace, the problem, though, with home care packages, you know, it's hard to get people to do that work because it's not all that well paid. It's difficult work.
Yes, but they're doing it. I tell you, my niece's son, he is actually doing it at the present time.
Okay.
But this is the only area. Apparently, there was one that for a while around Belfast someplace, there was this acute care.
It's everywhere, but it's getting the staff, it's getting the resources.
Not unfortunately. It's not everywhere at all. It's not.
Grace, you sound as if you want to come out of retirement.
No, I don't. I'm 85.
85 and you're ringing the Nolan Show. God bless you. Grace, thank you. Thank you.
Right, thank you.
We have a long, long queue. This is great. Thank you for all of your contributions, whether we agree with them or not. Alex is on the line from Lisburn, just up the road. Hi, Alex.
Hello, good morning. No, I just following the conversation, and I just think one of the problems is we haven't introduced, with the McGough report and different reports, we've never introduced the change that they recommend. And then we complain when the health service isn't fit for purpose. I mean, and you know, a lot of blame, I think, there lies with the politicians. We have two big parties in Stormont, and when the health came up, when the health department came up, they didn't take it. They ducked it. And they'd rather go in the local press, complain about what way it's been run, rather than supporting the minister that's involved, and rather support the minister to push through politics, push through policies that would help things. I was on the council for 4 years in Lisburn, Castlereagh. And
what party, Alex? So that we know where you're coming from. Ulster Unionist Party.
And there were changes.
Funnily enough, you're defending Mike Nesbitt.
Well, I would defend him because he's any health minister to be given the authority to go and bring about the changes.
Okay.
You know, they had the proposed changes to the casualty unit in the Lagan Valley when I was on the council. And again, it's been a success. But the call went from a lot of, mainly DEP actually, was, in fairness, was to put it out for more consultation. That's okay. Consult more. That's not make a decision. And that's endemic through the whole thing. When every time they went to close, again, I was on a commissioning group for the health service at that time.
Okay.
And we were going to close a minor treatment unit in Newton.
Sorry to interrupt, Alex. Let's cut to the quick here. Should Mike Nesbitt call in the army as a former Ulster Unionist councillor? Are you saying to Mike Nesbitt, the former leader of your party, bring in the military?
I'm not sure. I'm not in the position to say. If he thought it was the right thing to do, then he should be supported doing it. He's in the position to say. I'm not in the position to say. I don't know if it's a silver bullet. What he does need is support to bring about change to the health service and make it more efficient and get this notion out of our heads that the National Health Service is the be and end all, and it's the best solution to the problem to providing health care to the population.
I think I demoted him now. He's back as leader now as well. I mean, have you confidence in him?
He's leader as well. He's leader as well.
Yeah.
But
okay, Alex.
That's my view. And they need to bring about the change. And if that means you can't go to your nearest hospital to get all the services there, so be it. We're going to have to sacrifice that for a more efficient overall service.
Alex, thank you. What we've heard from Alex and Grace and Frank is the passion that we all have for our health service. And sadly, we all have people that are maybe in hospital at the moment or who have been in recently or who are maybe not too far away from having to go to hospital. Stephen's in Oma. Stephen, morning to you. What's your point?
Morning, Mark. Mark, my daughter was in A&E a number of months back and she waited 31 hours to get onto the ward. Okay. But I took the opportunity to talk to various people who was in the A&E with her waiting. And it's quite clear to me that a lot of those people turn up at A&E because they can't get an appointment with their GP. Now, if those people were to get an appointment with their GP, even for, say, tomorrow or the following day, they would know they're going to see a doctor at some point in the near future. But when you phone up the doctors at your GPs at the moment, you're told, you're either full up, try back tomorrow. So people don't wait for that. They'll go to their A&E. It doesn't make sense. Give the people appointments, even if it's the next day or the following day, they wouldn't be going near A&E, the moment bunging up A&E.
Stephen, thank you. You've hit on something here, whether that's true or not, that there are three aspects to this. There is what happens to people when they're in hospital. There's the whole aspect of preventing people having to go in the first place, and that's the point that you're making, that if there was more access to GPs, and a lot of them deny that there has been a reduction in terms of the access. And then thirdly, this whole issue of better and quicker care packages for people once they get out of hospital, or having them available so that people can get out of hospital quicker. I think Wayne in Warren Point has a point to make about that. Morning, Wayne.
Good morning, Mark. Happy New Year to you.
And to you.
I raised this a while ago. How many people actually is there in hospital permanently who can't get out with care packages? I often wondered if instead of giving people carers allowance, they automatically done was increased the carers allowance to give them a sustainable amount of money in order for them to look after their loved ones, which actually saves the government money by far because they have to maybe put them into a nursing home. Nursing homes cost about £700 to £1,000 a week. But some people have two parents at home. If they pay them a reasonable amount of money instead of relying on unpaid carers, they could actually tax them on the money if they needed to, if they give them enough of it, which could actually create employment plus take pressure off the health service. How many people is actually lying in hospital, unable to get home, just because they don't have a simple care package?
Wayne, what would you say is a reasonable? What would you say is a reasonable amount of money to pay an ordinary citizen, as such, to look after a loved one at home?
Well, I honestly think because they have no transport cost, they're probably living at home. £350. For Saturday, you got to remember, it's 7 days a week, 24 hours a day.
£350 a month or a week?
A week. It's the same as an income.
Okay.
Because some people have two people. Some people today, unpaid carers, are looking after two people for £81 a week. And they talk about the minimum wage, it's less than 20p an hour. But yet if they go into a nursing home, they have to find £1,000 per person. How come they can find this money, but they can't give it to loved ones or friends who are willing to do the job? They have to go out and go to work and can't give that level of care. It takes pressure off the system.
Wayne, thank you. We're getting very practical ideas here. And as I say, some of them are controversial, like charging people at A&E. Wayne's idea is to put a bit more money into loved ones who are looking after maybe elderly parents or uncles or aunties or people who are coming out of hospital rather than have to pay to put them into a care home. It's solution-based phone calls that we're looking for, and we're getting plenty of them. Keep them coming. Thank you. Teresa's solution-based. Hello, Teresa. Happy New Year to you in Ballanderry.
Oh, thank you.
Have you a solution?
Yes. They closed down the local hospitals, Mark. And to me, there's a perfectly good one close to me in Machaerfeld. They could assess people and move them on then to and more if they needed more treatment, and they could deal with the minor.
Is that not what GPs do, Teresa?
No, well, you can't get an appointment in GP.
Right, we're back to that. So spell it out, what you're saying, you're Machaerfeld, and you're saying open up a facility there?
Yeah, open up the hospital. It's sitting perfectly. It has a minor injuries only during the week.
Okay.
6 o'clock. They have clinics. They have different clinics going on in it. But the big hospital is sitting perfectly fit for a patient, closed.
Okay.
And when they built the Antrim Hospital, they knew that there wasn't enough beds, but they still went on ahead and closed it.
And who's going to staff it, Teresa?
They staffed it on New Year's Day. They opened it because of took the pressure off.
Okay.
So if they could do that one day, surely they could work something out.
Teresa, thank you. William's down the road in Armagh. Hi, William.
I'm inclined to agree with Teresa. Listen, for the last 50 years, Mark, they've been focused on closing down subacute hospital beds. And they've lost hundreds of beds over the years. And they try to replace this with, I think, a thing called high-tech medicine, just-in-time medicine. And that sort of medicine, okay, works for somebody acutely ill, but not somebody with a chronic illness that needs a bit of TLC and basic nursing care. So I think that they've lost sight of the way things are going. Around the Southern Trust, I don't know how many hospitals have been closed, acute hospitals, A&E departments, and concentrate in one hospital, Craigavon. And it has been shown over the years, not fit for purpose. It's not able to cope with demands at any one time. You just have to walk through the A&E in Craigavon, and it's like a war zone. Any day of the week, near enough.
And William, that public message that's gone out to all of us, no matter what age we are, to be careful this week. If we're driving, if we're cycling, even if we're walking on a pavement, if we're playing sport. Does that apply to you?
Oh, yeah. But listen, going back to the 70s, there were plenty of beds available for people to rest up for a week or two and then go on about their business. There is none now. There's acute beds and that's it. And they never get cold. Never get cold.
They never get cold?
No. There's always somebody in them.
William in Armagh, thank you. Let's go a little bit closer to where we are now. Let's go to the Shankill Road. Gary's on the line. Morning, Gary.
Good morning, Mark. Happy New Year to yourself and all the listeners and the staff there. Just to move across from A&E at the moment, just in support of the GPs and in particular the GP receptionists. While the pressure's on A&E, it's obviously moving across to GP and the receptionists, and people need to take a step back and remember that GPs, receptionists, they're only human. They have sick days as well, so they be understaffed. And the appointment system is set up as such as that when you ring in or when someone rings in, there's a set amount of appointments. And I know people saying they can't get an appointment, but once those appointments are gone, they're gone off the screen. So it's not the receptionist's fault. And people seem to take it out on the receptionist all the time. You know, they're doing their job. And, you know, if you have 30 or 40 appointments for a set day and those appointments are gone, they can't just magically, you know, pull an appointment for you out of the earth. So what you have is, if it's a minor ailment, you can go to your local pharmacy and they'll deal with you and over the counter and get you in and out in the space of a couple of minutes. If it's minor ailments, if it's an emergency, obviously you have to go to the A&E. But, you know, just remember that before you start abusing the receptionist, it's not their fault, and they are getting abused across the board. I see it daily, so I do. But maybe take a wee step back and remember that, as I say, once the appointments are going, they're there to help you, and they'll help you in every way they can, and they do. But, I mean, they're only human, and if the product's not there, if the appointment's not there and the solution's not there, it's not their fault.
Why are you defending GP surgeries, Gary? Are you involved in the health system?
Yes, I work in it daily. I'm going around them now, you know, and I hear it, you know. I've been in some of the abuse. Some of them get, you know, it's not nice. And they just have to sit there and take it because they've no solution. And it is not their fault. And let's not forget, you know, we're on here this morning and we're mentioning all the hospitals in Northern Ireland. This is across the board. You know, you go across the border into the Republic, it's as bad down there. It's as bad over in the mainland and indeed probably across Europe. So it's not a problem exclusive to Northern Ireland. And as I say, when you go to triage, even at the A&E, don't abuse the front line staff, because they're the staff that control everything. They're your go-to people. And, you know, without them, it completely breaks down.
Gary, thank you. Happy New Year to you as well. Linda in Belfast, what's your point?
I just want to say that I was at A&E in December, and within 5 minutes, I was triaged and taken in and admitted.
Lucky you.
So if it is a genuine, well, I could hardly breathe.
Sorry. Yes, fair point.
So if it is a genuine emergency, you will get taken.
Okay.
Now, while I was admitted, I think the problem is there's private rooms. You know, a lot of the rooms have all got TVs. So I was in the corridor, which I didn't mind. I just wanted to be in hospital. But that's taken up a lot of space. You know, and then a lot of patients when I was there, you know, a few of them were there with really severe mental health issues.
Mm.
Nowhere else to go. So they're taking up one of the rooms with like the bed and private toilet, TV. So it only leaves corridors because there's nowhere else for them to go.
Linda, I'm so glad that you phoned in, because that is such an important message. You were a genuine emergency and you were seen.
Yes, and I was taken straight away at the Ulster Hospital. Couldn't fault them at all.
That's important for people to know that.
Like it was, I took ill while I was abroad, and I arrived off the plane severely ill. Rang my GP. I actually got to see my GP within seconds.
Oh, that's good.
Can't fault the GP either. Yeah. Sent me to A&E and I was admitted straight away.
We like a good news story. How are you keeping now, Linda, just briefly?
Yeah, all good. All good.
Good on you, Linda. Good. Happy New
good
Year
for
to
an
you.
Hour day of complaining.
Quick word. We've got 30 seconds with John in Belfast. Quick point, John, before we get the 10 o'clock news.
All right. Thank you very much and Happy New Year. I was just speaking to some of your colleagues there to tell them that just before Christmas, I went to visit some of my friends. I'm a retired nurse in the big hospital. I hadn't seen them for 5 or 6 months, but when I did get there, I discovered, to my horror, they had all left.
Oh, my goodness.
They couldn't take it.
Oh, John, that's the other side of the coin. We do feel for all the medics out there, for the nurses, for the doctors, for the care workers. John, thank you very much indeed. Your stories just keep coming. We're going to keep at this week. Tell us your experience in A&E, good or bad. Keep the calls coming to The Nolan Show. You probably could name them all there. Sean Rafferty, Gloria Honeyford, Gerry Anderson. Oh my goodness, the halcyon days of Radio Ulster, but they're not over yet. Thank you for all your calls. We're delighted to hear from you, even though some of your stories are hard to listen to. We're going to talk more about the pressures on our health service before the end of the programme. So keep the calls coming in. But first, a story about the late Queen. According to newly released state papers from Dublin, the Queen once referred to the marching season as that silly marching business. She's said to have made that remark 25 years ago privately at a Buckingham Palace garden party. The alleged remark was then reported back to Dublin by the then Irish ambassador in London, Ted Barrington. So do you believe it? Do you believe the Queen actually referred to the marching season as that silly marching business? We'll ask the Orangeman, Tom Elliott, now Lord Elliott, of course, and a former Ulster Unionist Party leader, in a moment. But let's get a view from the other side of the Irish Sea. Talk to the former Labour Special Advisor, Kevin Maher. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. So you're talking about a woman living in England in what? Probably her early 70s, back in the year 2000, looking across at Northern Ireland and referring to our marching season as that silly marching business. We've only one person's word for it. So do you believe it?
I do, and I think there's two key things to point out at the start. One is that the Irish ambassador at the time, Ted Barrington, recorded these remarks and in a letter back to the to his political high ups back in Dublin, and quoted, put this in speech marks. It was a direct quotation from his exchanges with the Queen, and he did mention as well that she'd intimated similar sentiments to him in the past. Now, that's what ambassadors do. This is not some sort of leak or tittle-tattle, and it's not obviously contemporaneous. This is from 25 years ago, but this is what ambassadors do. They do this all the time, and the Queen would have known that too, given she's probably dealt in the course of her reign with thousands of ambassadors in that position. So it's interesting that this remark has been made. I've no reason to doubt the validity of what he said. There's no reason for him to confect this. The second thing is, I suppose, is the question is, why would she not think that? We know for a fact that Queen Elizabeth was, as head of the Church of England, took a Christian faith incredibly seriously, but she was also incredibly enthusiastic about Christian ecumenism, which is, I have to put it mildly, not what the Orange Order is all about. So it doesn't surprise me that this was said, and it doesn't surprise me that this is what the Queen probably felt. Now, some people will take from this, look, actually, there's no corroboration, there's no proof. It could have been, you know, the remarks could have been a bit more elliptical. They could have meant something else. But it wouldn't surprise me at all if this was slam dunk what the Queen actually thought and what the Queen actually said.
In diplomacy, though, is there not a protocol that, you know, what could have been just a throwaway remark doesn't make it back to your home nation as such in black and white?
Well, I think given the context of the times, and given where we were with the peace process, still very much, you know, the cement was still wet on the Good Friday Agreement, if I can put it like that. Perhaps it always is.
Yes.
But it doesn't surprise me that these remarks would have been said in the context of a conversation about where have we still got political problems? Where have we still got pressure points? And it doesn't surprise me that this was the kind of topic of conversation that came up. And I have to, you know, I mean, you look at the kind of the form, if you like, of the royal family, and their views on Ireland. And, you know, you look at the state visit that the Queen made to Ireland in 2011, which was, you know, really, really profoundly important. You know, state visits, sometimes Queen's going around and seeing things and all the rest of it. But, you know, the remarks that she made in Ireland were a genuine attempt to find common ground and a healing. And of course, she laid that wreath at the Irish Garden of Remembrance in Dublin as well for those that fought against her forces during Ireland's War of Independence and after that as well. So the Queen was, I think, a great fan and great supporter of Ireland. And I think that's not just people in Northern Ireland. It's not people just from the Unionist community. It's the whole of Ireland. I think she had a great fondness, obviously, as a horse racing woman as well. So she had great fondness for all parts of Ireland and all peoples. And of course, this is something that predates her and succeeds her. In 2019 at the Irish Embassy, Prince Charles, as he then was, with the Duchess of Cambridge, talked about having visited 15 Irish counties. And, you know, there was a wonderful remark he made, which he, I'll just very, very quickly quote it, that he said, quote, that he was quite determined that before I drop dead and finally lose my marbles, he should get to the remaining 17 counties. Mm. So there's a great affinity there with Ireland in its biggest, clearest sense. So I think, you know, the King, the Queen, it wouldn't surprise me. They don't like division. And of course, George V, when he opened the Northern Ireland Parliament in 1921, was very clear on this point. You know, I inaugurate it with deep felt hope, and I feel assured that you will do your utmost to make it an instrument of happiness and good government for all parts of the community which you represent. So, you know, we can see all the way through from the Queen's, you know, predecessor but one and her successor, a great affinity and friendship for Ireland. So it doesn't surprise me that this was of a piece with, I think, probably the Queen's views. And as I say, you know, it's in the mist of time a little bit about the corroboration of this. However, I would buy it.
You buy it. Tom Elliott, do you buy it?
Good morning, Mark, and a happy new year to you.
And to you, Tom.
All of your listeners. And I was just listening to that 25-year clip, and I was wondering if you were part of that, but I can't recall. But anyway, getting on to the Queen's alleged comments. Look, I'm not saying that she didn't, that the ambassador is making this up. Look, she may have said something similar in a different context or in a context that's not recorded. And you have to look at the time that there was whenever Republicans were going out of their way to stop Orange and Loyal Order parades. They were organising protests. They were bussing people in from various other locations. And, you know, it could have been done in the context. Well, look, this marching business and obviously the whole connotations around it, which were the Republican protests and trying to stop people going and coming to from their church service.
So you don't think, Tom, sorry to interrupt, you don't think it's a dig at the Orange Order then?
No, I don't think so at all. I think, you know, there may have been comments said in a context that certainly wasn't recorded by the ambassador. So I don't think the Queen or the Royal Family were having a go at the Orange Order, the Loyal Orders. There has always been a good relationship. The Orange Order has always shown loyalty to the Queen and the late Queen and the Royal Family and the present King. Present King, in fact, visited Loch Gall, the headquarters of the Orange Order, and had very, very positive remarks about it. And look, do have to say, the Orange Order do go out of their way to make friends, make relationships. And look, just because we hold a religious view, that doesn't make us any different to the Church of England or the Roman Catholic Church that hold their specific religious views as well.
Kevin, were you scoffing?
I'm scoffing at the characterisation of the order. I mean, you know, we can wax lyrical all day about whether it's pro-Protestant or anti-Catholic. I would argue it's very much anti-Catholic, and the evidence has been there for a very long time to substantiate that.
But I'm just wondering, Kevin, have you ever attended any Orange 12th sin? And I would give you an invitation to County Fermanagh to come to Orange 12th just to see the relationships, because we've had people up from Limerick, from Longford, from Sligo, people who certainly wouldn't have been sympathetic to the Orange Order, and have come there and had great events. Now, we've had exchange visits as well, where members and representatives from the Orange Order have went to visit their communities as well. So I have to say, I think that's coming from someone who probably just doesn't know or understand the organisation fully.
Well, as a Roman Catholic myself, if you, of course, invited me, you might get booted out of the order yourself for facilitating that.
Absolutely not, Kevin. No, and that's an open invitation. And we've had people from the Roman Catholic community come and attend the 12th of July in County Fermanagh. We're very welcome, and I'm happy to put you in contact with some of those if you have any concerns about it, to hear the views that they had in the times gone past.
Well, Tom, I salute your endeavours and I wish you well in them, but I suspect there's an awful lot of ground to make up, and, you know, there's probably not a lot of people from a Catholic background that will be buying that. But anyway, that's not the issue we're talking about.
Well, I'm sorry, Kevin. I do have to come back. That is not our experience, and I'm happy to have a further discussion with you around all of this to try and ensure that if you came to County Fermanagh 12th, that you would be made extremely welcome and you could enjoy the festivities the same as everybody else does.
Can I just ask how many times Queen Elizabeth visited an Orange Order event on the 12th during her 69 years on the throne?
Well, that I'm not sure at all, and I'm not sure that
would it be
actually
none?
She did get an invitation, but I know the current King got an invitation to the Loch Gall headquarters of the Orange Institution, and he came with open arms and welcome, and he was welcomed there. He had a good event, and the positive vibes came from it, and very much in a positive manner, Kevin.
Certainly, but has he ever attended an event on the 12th?
I'm not sure, but the current day, and I know you're a Labour spad, but the current Labour Secretary of State for Northern Ireland visited the Fermanagh 12th last year.
I'm sure he would. That's part of his job. But when was the last time a member of the British Royal Family attended a 12th event?
Well, look, I have no idea around that, and I don't know. All I'm doing is you're making an assumption around what we do in the 12th and around parades. I'm merely doing is trying to allay those fears of yours, because you're obviously communicating that to other people. So I'm saying to you, irrespective of what the Royal Family have done in the past, I'm saying to you, come you and visit our 12th. And you make your own assessment at that stage then, Kevin.
I'd rather not attend events with the burning effigies of the Pope and what have you. But
well, I have to say, Kevin, no, we don't burn effigies of the Pope at the 12th of July parade. I'm sorry. You see, that is a misconception that you seemingly have, Kevin, and that you're pretending to other people. And the lack of knowledge and the lack of understanding of the organisation. So if you're not prepared to come, then it's unfair of you to make those suggestions and allegations against the organisation that you don't know enough about.
Just to bring this back to the issue we're talking about, we can't determine whether any member of the British royal family has ever attended a 12th event. So does it really come as a great surprise that the Queen would have referred to the events as that silly marching season, silly marching business?
Well, she may have made similar comments, but it doesn't say in what context, Kevin. It could be to do with the Republicans who were protesting against those events and those parades and who were stopping people from going to their place of worship. I'm sure that is something that you wouldn't want to support either. Stopping people from going to their place of worship or coming from it, would you?
Unless it involved marching past places where people demonstrably did not want the Orange Order to pass by them, I would give due consideration
to other parts of the community. Would you support people? Sorry, Kevin, let me finish. Would you support them people? Would you support people being bussed in to stop people? Parading from their church that don't even those people that were bussed in to have that protest, they don't even have any affinity with that local district.
I mean, I would just refer you back to the remarks I read into the record a few minutes ago about George V in 1921. Shall I say them again, just so you've got them? I feel assured that you will do your utmost to make it an instrument of happiness and good government for all parts of the community which you represent. Now, at no point ever, unfortunately, in the history of Northern Ireland, has the Orange Order ever done that?
Well, I think that's where you're wrong, and you're making those judgments, Kevin.
But
those are King George's words, not mine. But you're making the comments about the Orange Order. You're saying they never did that. I'm saying you're making those comments on the basis without knowing enough about the organisation. And that's why I'm giving you an invitation. I'm asking you to come and have a look, experience some of the festivities yourself, and then you can make a better judgment.
Happy to do that. I suspect we'll still have to agree to disagree, as ever with these issues, Tom, but there you go.
So, Kevin, you're going to go?
I'm happy to go. If diary permitting, I'd be quite fascinated, actually.
Well, we might send a camera. We'll keep in touch, Tom. What about that?
That's fine. That's great. Look forward to it.
Well, there we are. We've got a date. The first date of 2025 is going to be Kevin Marr and Lord Elliot in Fermanagh on the 12th of July. Put that in your diary. Thanks to Kevin. Thanks to Lord Elliot. The time is just coming up to 20 past 10 this Monday morning. And what a Sunday afternoon it was yesterday at Anfield.
Bruno Fernandes now finding a pass through to Martinez in the box on the left. Went for goal! He scored! Now on the left-hand side, Liverpool. Oh, opportunity here. Oh, what a finish that is! Cody Gakpo! That is absolutely magnificent! This to give Liverpool the lead from the penalty spot. Salah drives it low. A chance and a goal! Amadiallo, left foot 10 yards out, steered it low past Alisson. And now Manchester United are back level, it's 2-2.
And it should have been 3-2. Harry Maguire missed an absolute sitter for Manchester United in the last minute, but it didn't negate the fact that United really battered Liverpool, even though they hadn't been given a chance before kick-off. People thought it would just be a question of how many Liverpool would win by and they would stretch their lead even further at the top of the Premier League. But Manchester United surprised everyone with a battling performance, showed a bit of character that we haven't seen for a very long time. So is this a turning point for Manchester United and their many fans out there? And I know a lot of them are listening to the Nolan Show. Let's speak to the chief sports correspondent at the I newspaper, Kevin Garside. Kevin, were you as surprised as everybody else yesterday?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, look, they couldn't catch a break, could they, beforehand? Yeah, and they were completely devastated. I was up in Manchester for the Newcastle game, and that first 10 minutes was scary. Anybody who's followed Manchester United, just awful. First half an hour was like 2-0 down. They hit the post. They'd had a goal disallowed. Isaac was all over them, and United looked lost, aimless. This for me went back to the early moments under Amorim, where they at least looked organised against Arsenal before losing. They controlled that game, and of course they won at Manchester City, so they have shown that they can do this. But overall, this was consistent from first to last, wasn't it? They weren't attacking Liverpool, but they had an element of control, and they weren't porous, and Salah wasn't in the game. And then it was the second half, the whole game blew up, and they could have won it at the end, as you said. It's amazing.
You make a good point, though, Kevin. We've seen a few false dawns, including winning at Manchester City recently. Yep. Is this a real turning point, do you think?
Well, only if they go to Arsenal at the weekend in the FA Cup and do something similar. They then have got a run of matches, which, that awful thing, if you look on paper, they're winnable. I mean, nothing's winnable for United at the minute. But, for example, they play Southampton at home, and I'm afraid if you can't take 3 points off of Southampton at home, maybe you do deserve to be in a relegation battle. But, there were some key shifts, some key things happened yesterday, which showed that if they keep this core together, they can be productive. And I think, Bruno rightly was man of the match, but Ugarte and Mainoo in the middle were fantastic. And that was the element that suffered. We were beaten up against Newcastle, and they got that right against Liverpool.
So relegation is now off the table?
Well, you're speaking to someone who was an observer in 1974 when Dennis Law back-heeled them into the. I think it always was. At some point yesterday, United fans were like cheering when Fulham equalised late on against Ipswich, thinking, well, thank God for that, because they actually think that they were getting dragged into something here. I was less certain of that. I think that was more of a motivational tool by Amorim to get the players up. But they were only five points above, weren't they? And but now the things got so bad, that point has taken them above West Ham, and that's something to cheer about. But I think you'll see United gather this from this now, and hopefully move on.
Yeah, here. Sorry, I have to declare an interest here. Stay with us, Kevin Garside. Andy Bell is on the line. Let's get a Liverpool perspective. Andy contributes to the Liverpool podcast, Anfield Wrap. Andy, you got a bit of a shock yesterday.
Yeah, we certainly did. It's one of those fixtures where the form book sort of goes out the window a lot of the time. I grew up, I think I was 11 years old the first time I remember Liverpool beating Manchester United. But even when United were winning league after league after league and Liverpool were in the doldrums, you always felt Liverpool could go there and get a result. And unfortunately, now that Liverpool are the dominant side, Manchester United are in the bottom half of the table, it's still the case that that this fixture just goes up in the air sometimes. It shouldn't have been a shock to Liverpool. It was the exact same fixture this time last year. Around Christmas time, Liverpool flying, Manchester United getting beaten every week, and United came to Anfield, frustrated us, and got a 0-0. So it shouldn't have been a sort of lack of desire and motivation from Liverpool yesterday, because we knew that this could happen. But that is no excuse for the performance that was put in. It is the worst performance of the season, I think, up there with Nottingham Forest. Got to give credit to United. They were fantastic. But yeah, there were plenty of poor individual Liverpool performances.
And Andy Bell, as a lifelong Liverpool supporter, can you confess on live radio that Manchester United deserved a win and should have had 3 points and they were robbed?
Absolutely. Yeah, no issue with doing so. Manchester United were the better side. I said when United went 1-0 up that it would take a draw, just the way the match was going and the way Liverpool were playing, the lack of chances that were created, the lack of control that Liverpool had, especially in the midfield, where I think Manchester United were completely dominant. I think your previous caller there is right to mention the performances of Ugarte and Mainoo, who were both excellent in the middle of the park. Liverpool didn't get near them. And when 7 minutes went up for added time, Liverpool top of the league against Manchester United in 14th, I should have been buzzing. But I said to the guy next to me, I'll take a point here. I just want to come out and get a 2-2. And that was proven because Harry Maguire missed a 10 out of 10 chance at the end, which I don't think I'd be talking to you this morning if that had gone in.
So. No, too soon. Pat the Taxi Driver's on the line, another lifelong football supporter of Manchester United. Well, Pat, what do you think?
Mark, isn't it ironic listening to those Liverpool supporters? I were getting text messages before the game. Liverpool were going to beat Man United 5-0. They were going to beat them 6-0. They were going to destroy them. And then during the game, a big friend, Gavin, he sent me a wee emoji of laughing whenever Liverpool got the penalty, went 2-1 up. He says, this is a stroll in the park. United turned up for the game, Mark.
Yeah.
But, Mark, United were robbed. See that penalty? That was hard.
I agree.
And then whenever Nunes went in with that tackle, see if that had been a United player, he would have been red carded. We were robbed, Mark. Mm. Absolutely robbed. Mm. And it's good to see. I wouldn't say we've turned the corner, but at least we know that there's something there. You know,
the ref sometimes can only give what he sees. Back to Kevin. Kevin, for all us Manchester United fans, are Liverpool going to wipe the smile off our faces? Do you think they're still going to win the league?
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I mean, I've been massively impressed with Liverpool this season. Seen them a couple of times up there, and they are devastating. And I think they missed Szoboszlai yesterday. I think he's come to the fore for them this year, this season, and his breaking from midfield was a loss to them, which Jones, who I think is a cracking player, just didn't offer that. And the other thing that United did well was keep Mo Salah quiet.
Yeah.
And he had very little game action in that opening half hour. That was vital. And then once they broke through the Trent barrier, the poor lad fell away, didn't he? And they were very productive down that side. But no, I think Liverpool's title, I assured. Other teams, Arsenal dropping points, Chelsea dropping points. And the question is, where do United go from here? They're still not scoring proficiently enough, and they're not threatening the keeper enough. The first half, I thought, you know, Liverpool were the team in the ascendancy. United were just not hanging on, but controlling the ball as best they could without threatening. They learned that how to threaten the second half, but that's what they've got to take forward. They've got to find a way through to goal.
And do you think, Kevin, they're going to buy? Amorim's going to be given a chequebook for January or not?
Not without selling. No, PSR has got them over a barrel, I'm afraid. And, you know, and who's going to buy Rashford on $350,000 a week? You know, I mean, even the Saudis are blinking at that. You know, PSG, maybe there might be a deal there, but it'll be a loan deal, I feel, somewhere. The kid's got to go, it's clear. And it's a shame in many respects. But it looks like the end of the road from him there. But I think it's going to be difficult for him to buy. And I think that'll have to come in the summer when they ditch some of the big earners, the big wage earners. That's what's crippling them at the moment.
Yes.
Casemiro, Rashford, etc., etc.
Kevin, thank you. Final word to Andy and then Pat. Andy, are Liverpool going to win the league still?
I think so. Yeah, I'm quite confident. Far be it from me usually to declare anything this early. It's a big month for Liverpool. They now go to Nottingham Forest next Tuesday night. Brentford next Saturday, who have a fantastic home record. And we've got to go to Bournemouth before the end of the month as well, who are flying. So I've had a look at the fixtures. Sort of 9 out of the last 10 away games are actually very tricky. So there is a case in which Liverpool can drop points and let Arsenal back in. However, I'm glad to say so far that any time we have dropped points, Arsenal seem to have dropped points in the same weekend, which is a massive relief to us. Just on one quick point there, I think the previous caller is spot on Szoboszlai. Szoboszlai's a runner. That's why Arne Slot loves him.
Gotcha.
I think we massively missed him yesterday.
And final word to Pat. Pat, Manchester United FA Cup holders, are we going to win the Cup again at least this year?
Always have faith, Mark. Always have faith. And the thing that would surprise me there, somebody mentioned Mo Salah. Was he playing yesterday?
Exactly.
I thought he was in. Wonder is he out of that boy's pocket yet? You know what I mean?
Good point, mate. Thanks, Pat. Thanks for all your calls. We'll have a lot more on the health service tomorrow. Thanks for your company. The one and only Connor Phillips is next.
Biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet at Stephen Nolan. Stephen Nolan Show.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking, and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this secret that's there.
I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.